Well, despite Jim Duff not being able to find me, as Mark Twain said, rumors of my demise are premature. This is one of those news days when stories came fast and furious, and phone calls came in just literally till 10 minutes before he went on air, and we did triage on them, and we'll be going all over the place. We'll be looking at a major labor decision in the United States that really impacts on public service employees and impacts on the right of collective bargaining and the right of workers to maintain their rights of collective bargaining. It's an issue that's being opposed by the National Association of Nurses in the United States, and it's going to have an impact here in Canada. We'll get to that a little later on. Lawrence Kaplan, senior editor of The New Republic, will join us to discuss the war in Iraq and how the United States can become the solution and not the problem. John Parisella will be joining us on the Mark Foley scandal in the States, and if you haven't been following that, you should, because here's a story of how a party can get hoisted on its own petard by covering up a lot of things it shouldn't have been covering up. There are flashbacks to our previous government in Canada, and we should pay attention to what's happening south of the border. We're 6 weeks away from the congressional elections. It'll have an impact on us. But we're starting with one of the keenest political minds in this country, a guy who talks straight from the hip, and the fact that he talks straight is already something special in this country. Warren Kinsella, journalist for the National Post, media columnist, media specialist, former assistant to Jean Chrétien, author, one of my favorite people. Warren Kinsella, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
I will not tell our listeners what I'm pulling you away from, because we are going to keep up the image of the serious political Warren Kinsella.
Well, that's somewhat difficult to do. But
not at all. That's what we need, false self-deprecation. Warren, in your column, for those few who might not read it, Warren Kinsella looks at the media for the National Post in a brilliant, trenchant column, and you really should be reading that every week. And you took on all the talking heads and all the sage pollsters who predicted that Ray would be the Liberal front runner. Now, you know, we've had Conrad Wynn on in the past and other polling company presidents. How did they get this one so wrong?
Well, in fairness to them, you know, I have committed the sin of polling myself. I've done some polls in my day, and
yeah, but you did it for the side of the Angels.
Yes, and what happened here, by way of background, is the Liberals had, as you've had mentioned on the show, this so-called super weekend, like a U.S. primary, where Liberal Party members were asked who they wanted to be delegates to represent them at the convention in Montreal in December. So, fine, that's okay. But ECOS, a polling company called Gandalf Strategic Council, which is Alan Gregg's firm,
right,
on behalf of various media organizations, and we're talking the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star here, went around to ascertain what the delegates supposedly thought and who they were going to vote for. So from Gandalf, we heard, for example, well, the guy who was going to come out as number one was going to be Ken Dryden with 20% of the vote, and Michael Ignatieff.
You know, I missed a Gandalf poll completely. They actually said Dryden, didn't they? Forgot that.
20% nationally, or Liberals, 20%, and Ignatieff being third. The strategic guy, council guys, Malin Gregg actually gave a quote that he probably regrets to this day, which is, well, you know, if you're a betting person, you put your money on Bob Ray. Well, anyway, as we all know, unfortunately, the punchline is the joke's on the polling agencies, because Ignatieff has got 30% as of Monday morning of this week. If you throw in the ex officio,
the Aboriginals,
senators and the Aboriginal Commission and former candidates and all that stuff, he's probably closer to 35%. And Ray, far from being in the lead, is in fact number two, quite far back. And in Ontario,
and didn't do so well in Ontario.
Well, he was a distant third in Ontario, where he supposedly had strength on the ground and had been premier for a different party, admittedly, but he was premier. So these guys, you know, this wasn't a margin of error thing. This was a great big honking margin of error. And the question I ask in the poll, you know, I mean, everybody's human and people make mistakes, but this seems to be a recurring pattern of behavior, where we're getting polls in the 2004 federal election campaign, 2006 federal election campaign, where people are just getting it plain wrong.
Warren Kinsella, please stay with us. We just got to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you for a couple more questions.
You bet.
Montreal, will be right back. And we're talking with National Post columnist and noted political commentator and author Warren Kinsella on how the pollsters got the Liberal leadership super weekend race results wrong. Warren, we were talking before the break about how everybody had Bob Rae in glowing first place. Now, was that a result of just bad polling, the wrong question being asked, or that other question that they all seem to have asked, who's your second choice, and then they sort of flipped the first and second questions together? Or don't they just flat out know what they're doing?
I think what happened, well, there's a phenomenon in market research that's been taking place. I mean, firstly, people are all, I'm speaking to you on a cell phone right now, and there are some people who actually don't have landlines anymore. I think actually last year was the first time in Canada's history that sales of cell phones exceeded that of landlines.
Yeah, it's almost cheaper sometimes just to have a cell phone.
That's right. So what's happening is it's becoming very difficult for pollsters to find people. Secondly, people are becoming adverse to spending half an hour or 20 minutes on the phone with a complete stranger confessing, as I put it in the column, their innermost thoughts. They're not wild about doing that. And what the third thing that's happening is we're seeing people actually fibbing. They are not indicating what their preference is. They're kind of stretching the truth a little bit. Now, to compensate for all of this stuff, what the pollsters are doing is starting to put together internet polls. And internet polls, particularly for political stuff, is really, really dangerous. Because the people you see on the internet, as you know, are people who generally are politically committed already. They're not people who have an open mind. Most of them, you know, have a pretty clear conservative point of view or a liberal point of view. So you're not getting that kind of voice of the people, average Canadian Joe and Jane front porch thing that you need in the polling business. So I guess I am making a little bit of an excuse for the media organizations because the pollsters are experiencing a lot of problems. But you know, the Toronto Star headline, September 25th,
right.
Rae poised to win Liberal leadership. Well, no. No, you know, even if he ended up being in the lead and he ended up not being in the lead, you shouldn't be saying something like that because there's all kinds of things that can transpire between now and the convention in Montreal 2 months from now. So I think it's the desire of media organizations and newspapers in particular to get the scoop, to be the first guy to declare, you know, it's a conservative minority government or conservative majority government. They're obsessed by that.
Warren, I know your time is pressed, but I want to ask you one last question, and let's get away from the polls for a second. You're still one of the best political minds in the country.
I love it when you flatter me.
It's not a flattery. It's true, and we all know that people are beating a path to your door for your involvement in their campaigns, or at least your sagesse. Let me ask you this. Are you getting a feeling, put aside the polls for a second and the headlines, are you getting a feeling that there's something happening between the Rae, Dion, and Kennedy camps, what is like to be called a soft center left, that they can coalesce and they'll bring their 55-odd percent together? Or can nobody deliver their delegates past the first ballot?
That is a very important question. The Liberal Party, as you and I know personally and just from our own experience, is in full-on revolt against the notion that there are ethnic warlords or regional warlords who say, all of my support is going to blank. Here's what's going to happen. That kind of stuff in the Liberal Party of Canada in particular is not happening anymore. So let me give you an example. When Maurizio Bevilacqua dropped out, he made a big show out of going to Bob Rae.
Right.
Every single one of his organizers, senior and junior, went to Ignatius.
And we heard that from Al Fapps the other night on the show.
Right?
Yeah.
When Hedy Fry, lesser example, you know, didn't have much of an organization, but she did have one, every single one of her organizers went to Dion, and so on and so on. So this notion that you can make a pronouncement I've done a deal with Bob Ray or whomever, and all my support's going to go where I say it should go. That's just not happening anymore.
So not only can they not deliver the delegates, they can barely deliver their top guys.
Right. So if I'm right on the numbers that Ignatieff is 30% now, we know that, plus 5% more given to him by the ex officio, all he needs to do is shake loose one out of every four votes between now and the convention, and he will win. He could win a first ballot victory. So this stuff that the media are feeding us in order to generate some excitement, I guess, that, you know, Ken Dryden can come from nowhere and win, it's crazy. It's impossible. It's just not going to happen.
Warren Kinsella, we thank you for your time. Montreal, Canada, everybody listening on the web, go to www.warrenkinsella, one word, warrenkinsella.com. It is consistently named one of the best spots on the web. Everybody who's anybody in politics goes to read what Warren has to say on his site and look for his column every week in the National Post. Warren, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, my friend.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, from Canadian politics in Montreal and Ottawa, we're going down to Washington, and one of the keenest Canadian observers of the American scene, John Paracella, is with us. John, welcome. Thank you for taking the time.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Beryl.
John, we Canadians don't pay enough attention to what happens south of the border, but there's a lot of there's a mirror there that reflects back to us. It's not just that the elephant gets a cold, we get pneumonia, but sometimes politically the same lessons are learned. And the Mark Foley scandal is something that perhaps Canadians aren't paying enough attention to, but I think they should in the following sense. You've got a party that runs on moral values and family values, and if there's protection of a guy like this, who is allegedly made passes at least, if not more, on congressional pages, you're hoisted on your own petard, and we've lived through that in Canada. And I want to delve into that, John, with you right after we pay one short bill.
Will do.
We'll be right back. It doesn't really matter if you're in politics if you have carnal knowledge of a McCormick Reaper tractor. But if you're going to run on family values and you're caught with the tractor, you're going to have a problem. And our special guest, John Paracella, is going to tell us how the Republicans screwed up and what that means for any party. We just lived through the liberal wars, and I can't think of anybody better suited to talk about this. I mean, John, what haven't you done? You've been, you know, chief of staff to Premier Bourassa. You're president of the leading public relations company. I mean, you know what politicians shouldn't do. How badly did the Republicans screw up in the cover-up?
Well, it all comes down to walking the talk, you know, and this cover-up, as you say, really the problem was when the leadership did not act on something that clearly was a problem, and now we know that it was a problem that existed for at least a year, and they did nothing about it. So right off the bat, they talked about moral values, and they have the ultimate case of an absence of moral values, and it's biting them in the proverbial back end. And at the same time, they're fighting a very unpopular war. Already Mr. Bush was trying to get the upper hand. He's trying to force this midterm election on the basis of foreign policy, and specifically the security of the United States, and he has had trouble getting traction, but he was getting traction in the last 10 days before the scandal.
Yeah.
And this scandal has completely brought it back to square one. And while I still think that the Republicans will hold on to one of the two houses, as much as I thought 10 days ago they were going to hold on to both houses, I'm not as certain right now. And that has to have an impact on how American foreign policy will be conducted over the next 18 to 24 months.
If this wasn't a mid-year election, would this scandal have gotten the media attention it did, or just gone by the wayside after 5 days?
I think it would have gotten the attention. You know, ever since the Lewinsky Clinton scandal, it's clear that there's an appetite for this. As you know, Beryl, 24-hour news, specialized news stations like CNN, Larry King has been able to carry these types of shows for weeks on end. He did it with the Gary Condit case a few years ago.
Forever and ever.
So, no, I don't think they could have gotten by. This is if you pardon the expression, as juicy a scandal as you can find. And it is also being played out in a very decisive or important state, which is Florida. Florida is a state that's up for grabs.
Yep.
Anybody who wants to be president knows that they got to win that state.
And Bush grabbed it in 2000.
He grabbed it in 2000, of course, and that remains doubtful. But he did win it fair and square in the last election.
What'd you say? He stole it? No, he won it. Sorry, I was thinking of Murray Chotiner in 1960 telling Nixon they stole it fair and square. Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good one. You've got a good sense of history, Beryl. So, but no, when you really get down to it, the Republicans are going through a very difficult time, and I think it's like in anything, whether you're talking Canadian or American politics or any Democratic system, there's always cycles, and they're in a really bad cycle right
now. It's also the cover-up. That it's the lies. It's not even the event. It's the cover-up that's always the worst disease.
Well, the cover-up was the worst thing that happened in the Watergate scandal, much more than the crime. And and that's where they're still stuck with a cover-up on this one. I don't know how Dennis Hastert, who's the
Speaker of the House,
can really survive long-term on this.
People were shocked today that he didn't resign. He merely called him the former head of the FBI to do an investigation of congressional pages.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's obviously in a defensive mode, but there's no way that he's going to gain on this one. As you know, it's very similar to a House of Commons MP, and he can only win his seat. I don't think he's got a coattail effect in getting more Republicans elected. In fact, the more he's there, he will become the face of the cover-up. Foley is the face of the scandal. Hastert is in the process of becoming the face of the cover-up, and I don't think Republicans are at ease with that. I don't think he might survive, but I'll tell you one thing: if they ever lose the House, he's toast by Christmas.
Right, and we're under 4 weeks from the election
date.
Definitely. John Parasella, thanks very much for taking the time tonight. I know you had a tight schedule.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and it's always a pleasure to talk to the last angry man.
Oh, pleasure's always mine. Thank you, John. Montreal will be right back. Flip side of the news. Well, we've just finished talking to John Parasella about the Mark Foley affair in Washington and how a lot of things that start in America politically are reflected back into Canada, and we live through our own liberal wars. But other issues are always reflective, not only to Canada, but particularly to Quebec. I want to remind everyone listening, Quebec has a political jurisdiction, let me use that phrase carefully, is only one of five political jurisdictions in the world. Quebec, Denmark, Sweden, Italy, and Israel, where more than 40% of the population has some ties to unions. In the United States, the National Labor Relations Board, in a remarkable decision, remarkable in the sense that it went against, it narrowed the right of nurses to unionize by redefining definitions of supervisor, which put tens of thousands of nurses into the category of management and ineligible for collective bargaining. And as many of you know, we went through something similar in Quebec about 18 months ago, 20 months ago, when the provincial government tried to change Section 45 of the Labor Code. Basically, it would have allowed scab labor and basically would have made Quebec a right-to-work jurisdiction. And we at the Institute were involved with some unions, and we're very proud of the fact that 1.5 million Quebecers almost came into the streets. And that issue was dropped. But this issue is about to grow. It's going to grow in America, and it's going to grow again and rear its head as far as the right of public sector employees to unionize in Canada. And we're very privileged to have Diane Sosny with us tonight. And she is president of the Service Employees International Union, and particularly the SEIU's Nursing Alliance, of which she's headed since 1996. Diane, thank you very much for taking the time at the last minute to be with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
But it's really important for Canadians. We face these issues all the time, particularly in Quebec, on the labor front generally, but in the nursing area particularly. Can you walk us through exactly what the NLRB did in redefining supervisor and how many people that affects?
Well, what the ruling is that just came out is it's really narrowing the definition of what a supervisor is. In our case for nurses, and I should add that
it's not narrowing, it's broadening it.
I'm sorry. And in our case in the United States, this is covering private sector healthcare.
Right.
It's not covering public sector, but the public sector typically follows the private sector. And what it is saying is typically nurses were not considered supervisors if they didn't hire, fire, promote, or lay off coworkers or other members of the team. Now they're saying that they're not just limiting it to those functions. They're saying that if you assign or direct other employees in the course of your work, then you are considered a supervisor and therefore exempt under the National Labor Relations Act, and if you try to organize, are not protected by the law.
How many nurses could this affect?
This is tens, if not hundreds of thousands of nurses, because in our work in private sector hospitals, every work area, unit, ORs, recovery rooms, have charge nurses. And the case that this decision was based on is a hospital in Michigan, Taylor, Michigan, Oakwood Heritage Hospital, and the hospital claimed that the nurses who were charge nurses in the OR, and because they oversaw work of nurses aides, technicians, were management. And every unit has charge nurses round the clock. If they're a 24/7 unit, then they would have all three shifts. So it is impossible to determine exactly the number, because you could have a unit of 30 nurses, a med-surg unit, and have one charge per shift, and you could have a unit, a behavioral health unit, of five nurses, and you could have one charge nurse per shift.
So in Oakwood's case, where they might be saving a relatively small amount of costs, I don't even know if there are any costs related to the fact that they have unionized nurses, this decision can have a chaotic effect throughout the whole sector nationwide.
Absolutely. And I have to say that while we are not surprised by this ruling, we were anticipating that the Labor Board, which is now dominated by President Bush appointees, were going to come out with this decision. It really is a sad day in our country that this decision was came out the way it did. And I think what we find as nurses ironic is that, first of all, we have a president in this country who talks a lot about freedoms and how important it is for people, individuals, to have freedoms. Yet they've just narrowed the freedoms of nurses at the workplace.
Diane Sosny, please stay with us. We just have to pay some bills here. And I want to ask you about the potential reaction of the SEIU and give our listeners some background on you, the union, and Andy Stern. We'll be right back. And we're talking about an important U.S. National Labor Relations Board decision that substantively narrows the ability of nurses to unionize and to exercise the rights of collective bargaining. And we're privileged to have Diane Sosny joining us from Seattle. Diane is the president of the Nurses Alliance within the Service Employees International Union, affiliated with the AFL-CIO and the Canadian Labor Congress, and has a lot of locals in Canada. Diane, you were explaining what happened in this decision before the break, which is the Oakwood decision. Now, the president of the SEIU, Andy Stern, has been called by the New York Times as the man who's redefining labor and is leading labor into the future. Is there any move within the SEIU generally, not just within the Nursing Alliance, to take this on in a very aggressive way nationally, or at least in Washington?
Well, we will definitely pursue organizing nurses in this country for the following reason. We are facing a dangerous shortage of nurses to the point where we are estimating needing 1.2 million nurses to fill both new and vacant positions by 2014. Secondly, this is a very dangerous ruling. The implications for nurses and patients and being able to hold hospitals accountable for the quality of care that patients receive if nurses feel that their voice is being silenced, that they can be discriminated against or retaliated against because they would not have union protection, this we're patient advocates, and this ruling affects our ability to advocate for our patients. So the way we plan to address this is in our organized facilities, we are not anticipating our employers to be raising this. If they do, we will deal with that on a case-to-case basis. But what we've faced in our country is a hostile environment to labor for many, many, many years, and we've been, in our union, the fastest-growing union,
yes,
and have persevered in organizing nurses, healthcare workers, and other workers with or without having favorable help from any laws. And so in our reaching out to non-union nurses in this country who want to be part of an organization that's advocating not only for our patients in terms of quality care and safe staffing, but also for national health care reform, because we have 45 million people in this country who do not have health insurance.
You know, I'm sorry. I want to address that number because that's always bandied about. I want to make Canadians understand this and Americans listening, because the signal is heard in the States. It's 45 million without any health insurance.
Without any
health
insurance.
It's 135 million with substandard insurance that can cover only about 20 to 30% of their actual costs.
Correct.
So it's a big problem. And this kind of a decision can be mirrored, this kind of playing with words. And as a lawyer by training, you know, I know the danger of playing with words can certainly be mirrored by the Canadian Labor Relations Board. It can certainly be mirrored by provincial labor relations standards boards. So it's something that we have to watch here, too.
So we will be looking, I think there's a couple of ways we will be addressing this. One is, it's not going to deter us from responding to nurses who want a collective voice in the workplace. We have projects where we are working with nurses in a number of areas who are not yet union, who want to band together to work on healthcare reform and safe staffing in hospitals. We will continue to do that, and we have utilized very creative methods to bring people together and help people get unionized.
And go ahead, Dan.
Secondly, we will look for test cases where the employer in new organizing tries to apply this definition, and if we think it's a good case, we will file an unfair labor practice charge. So we're not going to sit back and have this deter us. If anything, this is going to make us more determined to be proactive and work together to solve the healthcare crisis and the nursing shortage crisis in this country.
And I want to make this clear to our listeners out there. Your problem with this is not that you want to force nurses who don't want to unionize or don't need to. What your concern is that this is going to force unionized nurses out of unions. And I want all our listeners, even the right to workers, to understand the danger of this decision. Diane Sosny, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Pleasure. One quick call before we get to our next guest, Sharon.
Hi, Beryl. How are you?
Good. Yourself?
Okay. I just wanted to say something about unionized people who are in supervisory positions. The problem there is not that they're part of the union, but they teeter on union management roles. For example, they can intimidate people who are under their care. They will collude with a boss. They may not say you're fired, suspended, or dismissed, but they will play into it, into management.
You're quite right, and that's one of the points Dan was making. But in this case, what the NLRB has done is they've taken and redefined the roles of already existing unionized workers, unionized nurses, in order to make it easier for the hospital. So they're not blocking people who don't want to be a member of a union. What they're doing is they're taking away union rights of existing union members.
That's totally disgusting.
Just to save this particular hospital in Michigan some money. Sharon, thanks very much for your call. We got to pay some bills, and thank you for listening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And thanks for calling. Ciao. We'll be right back. The genocide that followed in Cambodia and the spectacle of Vietnam's re-education camps will not be repeated in Iraq. But ask any American officer there, and he will tell you that without U.S. forces, Iraq's ditches will fill rapidly as the death toll multiplies tenfold. The United States owes Iraq many things. Being an engine of murder isn't one of them. And in Iraq, the United States isn't the problem. It's the solution. Tonight we've gone, listeners, from Montreal to Toronto to Seattle, and now we go to the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's God's country. But the author of these words is very much aware of the hell on earth in some places, but the responsibility, as he calls it, of moral force. We're privileged to welcome Lawrence Kaplan, senior editor of The New Republic. Welcome, Mr. Kaplan, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for being patient. We've got a North America that's 50-50 split. They half understand exactly the phrase you used, the moral force, the idealism behind the necessity of Afghanistan and Iraq and those missions, half who don't. What do you think is going to decide which way the political will goes?
Well, I'm afraid the question has already been decided. I think right now we're just running out the string. I think public opinion, at least in the United States, is pretty squarely behind withdrawing troops from Iraq. But I guess my argument is that regardless of what you thought about the decision to go into Iraq, now we've turned the country upside down, and we really are the only thing standing between what you see on your television sets today and just mayhem and murder of an entirely different order.
Lawrence, that murder and mayhem, I often wonder why that message isn't getting across. As bad as this infighting is between Sunni and Shiite, there are more Arabs killing Arab Muslims, killing Muslims. Why is the message that Saddam Hussein was killing 100,000 to 150,000 of his own countrymen every year, why is that not getting across?
Well, I think people just know what they see and what they see on their TV sets. It's very real, and it's chaos and murder, and it's very hard to chalk that up as a success story.
Well, so because they didn't see the barbarism of Hussein, the gassing of the Kurds, and they're seeing all the incidents today, is there no political leadership out there that can come out and say, hey, you know, America, this is what it was, this is what it is. Yeah, it's not easy. Nation building is difficult. But we have really freed a lot of people.
Well, I think, you know, the administration has tried and tried, but every time it seems to make some progress, there's some catastrophic event or the release of a very damning report or some other event that just sets back its public relations.
But you know, that public relations, you made a very good point, that intelligence report this week where one paragraph was released that questioned what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the president said, okay, so I'll release the whole report, the Democrats started to run, no, let's have private hearings, only the fifth private hearings, in-camera hearings, since 1820. They didn't want the whole report released because they took a paragraph out of context. And yet nobody from the administration was coming up forcefully and passionately and saying, hey, you know, the emperor has no clothes on the Democrat side. Is it going to take somebody of perhaps the authenticity or legitimacy of a John McCain to restore a message?
Well, actually, he's really one of the few figures, I think, who could, you know, still rally the country at this point. But I think as the elections grow closer, I'm not even sure where McCain's going to be a year from now. Now, I'm certainly not arguing that things are hunky-dory in Iraq. I've spent enough time there to understand that the situation's very bad, very, very bad. My only argument is that there's sort of a cognitive dissonance among the public because even though it's very hard to imagine, the situation there could get much, much worse if the American military leaves. Right now, it's really they're almost a buffer between various sects and tribes, and without them, you really do have full-scale civil war. And I mean, it would be a moral disgrace, and it would also just be a strategic catastrophe.
And one thing that I think people don't get is that this wasn't created by the Americans. This fighting is fierce, and we're seeing it. But every military man we've talked to, people, Canadians who are serving with the National Democratic Institute in Iraq and Afghanistan that we've talked to, has told us over and over again, it was worse before, we've got more infrastructure in place now, and we're really nation building, but that message isn't getting across. The medium is overwhelming the message, and perhaps we don't have the right messengers.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm part of it's just the nature of the news and of television, which is, you know, you don't see the 99% of the country that's relatively quiet day to day. What's newsworthy is the bombings and the bad news. That said, the bombings and the bad news are very real indeed. So it's just really it's a subjective determination about really what's relevant to play on the news. And to tell you the truth, on the nightly news these days, you hear about Iraq for maybe 5 seconds, and then they move on to
other
more
things.
Pressing matters.
Well, Lawrence Kaplan, as long as we have voices like yours talking about moral force, we've got some hope. And we want to remind everybody, as Alan Finkielkraut, the French philosopher, says, barbarism is not the prehistory of humanity, but the faithful shadow that accompanies us every step, and we've got to prevent that shadow from reappearing. Lawrence Kaplan, thank you very much for joining us. Nick Mays, thank you, and Master Control, and we'll be back with you on Monday.